Israel, Iran, nuclear weapons, and the United States. This is Weekday. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu believes Israel must prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. His government has refused to rule out military action. Meanwhile, the U.S. has renewed their call for tougher sanctions against Iran after Iran was caught violating the UN-imposed ban on exporting arms. And negotiations over Iran's nuclear programs have seemingly ground to a halt. Is this a volatile situation that ends in conflict? Can diplomacy resolve the conflict? And what does it say about the larger questions of peace in the Middle East? Dr. Mohammad Sahimi is professor of chemical engineering and materials science and also the National Iranian Oil Company professor of petroleum engineering at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He's written extensively on Iran's political development and their nuclear program, largely concentrating on the legal and technical aspects of the dispute between Iran and the Western powers over Iran's nuclear energy program. Blogs at Huffington Post, is a correspondent for PBS Frontline's Tehran Bureau. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, and thank you for having me in your program.
And it's very interesting. That's why I spelled it out. National Iranian Oil Company professor of petroleum engineering at USC. Just a reminder of the close ties that the U.S. had with Iran for many years.
That's actually true. That was the chair that in the 1970s the Shah of Iran established at USC for educating and training Iranian students in petroleum engineering. But after the revolution, my university changed the name to National Iranian Oil Company so that it would dissociate itself from the Shah of Iran.
Or NIOC, as it was.
NIOC, exactly.
Just an acronym. Dr. Ian Lustig is a professor and Bess Heyman Chair in Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He teaches courses on Middle Eastern politics, political identities and institutions, techniques of hegemonic analysis, including the expansion and contraction of states. He is past president of the Politics and History section of the American Political Science Association and the Association for Israeli Studies, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So you're both here in town because folks here decided, why not have a conference titled Iran, Israel, U.S. Resolving the Nuclear Impasse? Tonight, you're going to be doing that at Seattle's Town Hall. So I support you in getting that done tonight. Is there a way, from both of you, just the big picture first, are there ways to resolve this nuclear impasse, Professor Lustig?
Well, I think by redefining it, we have to be careful not to allow the interests of different parties in elevating one kind of problem into an image as being another kind of problem to define it so that it can't be solved. Countries are going to get nuclear weapons. That's been true in the past, and almost every country that has gotten nuclear weapons, including the United States, by the way, has done it secretly. In some cases, as in the case of Israel, the development of the nuclear capacity is never made official. Until the world is able to put in place a comprehensive program that can manage this, and it's likely we're going to have different kinds of problems. The Iranian nuclear impasse is mainly, I think, an impasse because we are overemphasizing certain of the dangers and not appreciating that although it is a serious issue, that the threat of nuclear war arising as a result of a screw being turned in a warhead, that's not the problem that we're facing.
All right. Let me get that same question answered by you, Professor Sahimi, but countries are going to get nuclear weapons.
Well, at least in Iran's case, what needs to be done is to keep Iran's nuclear capability latent. In other words, keep it under a strict inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran must sign the additional protocol of the International Atomic Energy Agency and implement it. That would allow the agency to have intrusive inspection of Iran's nuclear facility everywhere in Iran on short notice. And Iran actually did carry out provisions of that agreement between October of 2003 and February of 2006. So that is what needs to be done. I don't think the approach that Iran cannot have a uranium enrichment program in Iran is going to work. Iran is not going to give it up. bombing it is not going to make it go away, because Iranians will go underground and will redouble their effort to do what they want to do. At the same time, I believe if Iran is under a nuclear program, is only for purely as a deterrent, not as an offensive nuclear weapon. So in my view, the way to go is to keep the program under the most strict inspection by the international community, and to hold the country responsible and force it to abide by the obligations that it has under Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and its safeguard agreements.
Professor Sahimi studies Iran's nuclear weapons program. Professor Lustig studies the Middle East and Israel's weapons program. Israel has the bomb?
Well, there's no question about that, although it's only Israeli government officials who make a pretense of, well, officially there is no bomb, but they have about 400 weapons, some of them extremely sophisticated.
They have 400 nuclear warheads?
Yes, and very elaborate delivery systems, multiple delivery systems, and not just simple nuclear warheads, but warheads that can do a variety of things. This has been true since the late 60s, that is, some nuclear capacity. But Israel's policy has always been one of what is called opacity or ambiguity. So famously, Israeli leaders have said, we will not be the first country to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East, but we also will not be the second. That's actually the Israeli position. It's all part of an effort.
I don't even get what that means. Well, it's only be the third? Or?
Exactly. It's all part of an effort to, tongue-in-cheek, allow Israel to convince its neighbors that it has a nuclear capacity that should be an overwhelming deterrent without having to sign the NPT and be part of the official nuclear club and possibly be sanctioned, inspected, and so on. So what I see is very interesting in the current situation is that Iran is effectively trying to imitate Israel.
Yeah, it sounds like they are.
And what Israel is having difficulty with for a variety of reasons is that in order to object to the Iranian development of an ambiguous situation, similar to that which Israel had in the late 60s, where perhaps one turn of the screw is all that separates Iran from having a weapon, opens the critiques of Iran for that purpose, open up critiques of Israel. And there's a very maddening situation for Israeli leaders in which they had assumed that Israel could have a monopoly on this kind of a capacity, giving Israel a certain capacity to act under a nuclear umbrella with unilaterally to enforce its vital interests. But that meant that no other country in the Middle East could have that capacity.
Are you referring, and I want to get your thoughts on this, but are you referring, for example, to when Israel decided to bomb whose nuclear facility was
it? Iraq, but then recently a facility in Syria that the North Koreans seem to be helping with, or was it the Chinese? I think it was the North Koreans. So, yes, that's the type of thing, but not only that. And the idea that Israel is not the dominant power in the Middle East, that it might actually be contending on an equal basis with another power, it sends shivers down the spines of Israeli leaders for many good reasons, but not including the fear that Iran would actually try to drop a bomb on Israel.
The good reason being, you agree with this, the good reason being that a deterrent now the umbrella is shared.
excuse me. Not only that, but as I discussed in an article several months ago, I think the fear is that if there is another partner or another country in the Middle East, namely Iran, with nuclear weapon capability, the fear that it generates in Israeli society may actually reverse immigration to Israel and also make a flood of the intellectuals and the elite people leave Israel. And that, I think, that is the main fear in Israel, not that Iran is actually going to attack Israel. I don't...
You mean that it destabilizes Israel? The fact that they have it destabilizes Israel?
Yes. And I
don't...
Economically. Yes. I pointed out this in an article several months ago. I cannot think of any conceivable scenario under which Iranian leaders decide to attack Israel, because they know if they do that, Israel can evaporate Iran many, many times over.
Well, they have 400 weapons.
They have 400 weapons. So even if Iran, say, has a few nuclear weapons, what is it going to do? So that's not the fear. And in fact, Zipi Livni, the former foreign minister and prime minister, and also the present defense minister, Ehud Barak, have said that Iran is not an existential threat to Israel. So that's not the threat that they are afraid of. The threat is the instability that it may cause in Israel and reverse immigration to Israel.
This is very interesting. I, too, have written an article in the last year to, about specifically that. That is, it's the psychological impact that could have political consequences in Israel of having a country not just that has the bomb and its enemy, but talks Holocaust talk. Mm-hmm. Israel is a traumatized society. That's well known. The Holocaust, you cannot overestimate the extent to which it has permeated every nook and cranny of Israeli life. And one thing that the elite in Israel worries about is that if there is the image of a regime that has the capacity to incinerate Israel and speaks about Israel in terms that resonate with the Nazis, that the larger class that has the resources in Israel will not allow its children to live in the country. There's a real fear of emigration. By the way, there has been a significant emigration of elite from Jewish elite from Israel in the last 6-7 years. In fact, my calculations show that on average, there's been more Jewish emigration than immigration. So this is not a trivial issue, and this plays right into it, this whole nuclear fear. So there's a deep political, psychological level to this. When the hysteria that gets generated is not found, as we just heard, in the words of security experts in Israel. No security expert in Israel that I've been able to find argues that Iran would actually use nuclear weapons against Israel. Nor in the Israeli deputy foreign minister just posted an open letter to the whole Arab world. And part of that open letter, Dani Ayalon, and what he said was that he highlighted the threat of Iran to the Arabs as well as to Israel. But what he said was not that Iran would use a weapon, but that Iran would use a nuclear umbrella to advance Shia interests against the Sunni world. As I said, that is more or less what Israel has been doing, not for Shia interests, but for, you could say, Jewish interests in various ways. So this is a set of political and psychological fears that has got the Israeli elite in a very aroused state and one where they don't have a lot of good options.
Yeah, more knots. More knots that we have just tied and tightened on KUOW Seattle. Dr. Ian Lustig and Dr. Mohammed Sahimi talking about Iran, Israel, and nuclear weapons. We'll see if there's anything to be done to unravel those knots in a minute. This is Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
At its height, Yiddish was the language of nearly two-thirds of the world's Jewish population. Nowadays, though, Yiddish is on the brink of extinction. We'll take a look at the past, present, and future of the Yiddish language. That's tonight during the 10 o'clock hour. 94.9 KUOW News and Information. It's 9:19.
Support for KUOW comes from Tom Douglas Restaurants, including Lola, Etta's, and Palace Kitchen, now offering gift cards for holiday giving, available online and at all locations. Additional gift information can be found at tomdouglas.com.
. 51 degrees, overcast in Seattle, in Olympia, 49 degrees in light rain. Bellingham, 53, with a few clouds in the sky. Today's high in the 50s, cloudy and breezy with occasional rain showers. Tonight's low, 43, cloudy with rain. Tomorrow's high, 49, chance of morning rain, then rain likely in the afternoon.
There's a panel discussion tonight, Iran, Israel, U.S., resolving the nuclear impasse at Seattle's Town Hall. I'm Steve Scher. This is Weekday on KUOW Seattle. Among the participants in that discussion, Dr. Mohammed Sahimi, who has been looking at Iran's political development and nuclear program from his place as professor of Chemical Engineering and Materials Science and the NIOC Professor of Petroleum Engineering at the University of Southern California, and Dr. Ian Lustig, who's professor and Bess Heyman Chair in Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, let's talk a little bit about what untangles those knots. And if you have questions, comments, thoughts, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. I'd like you to join us. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. So what untangles those knots? And are these current sanctions discussions and regimes and back and forth that's taking place between the U.S. and Iran and the EU? What was there, a recent release of a secret memo from that the Times of London came out with, saying, look, this proves that Iran is building towards nuclear weapons, a neutron initiator. You can tell me what that is. But is there anything in these discussions, Professor Sahimi, that's helping to unravel these knots, or are they just tightening them up?
Well, first of all, let me explain about the recent apparently secret memo. The neutron initiator is something that you, in order to make a nuclear weapon to go off, you need an initiator that triggers the nuclear reaction. And apparently the memo has been about the process and how to work that out. But at this time, I'm skeptical about the authenticity of the memo because many of such memos have leaked in the past by the Times of London, which was the original of this memo, and have turned out to be wrong. And in fact, they have forced International Atomic Energy Agency to deny those allegations made by the Times of London.
Is that right?
Yes.
The Times is not credible on this.
Not on this particular issue, even though it's a lot, very important newspaper in Britain and in the world. As I said, International Atomic Agency has repeatedly issued a statement denying many of these allegations. So at this point, at least, the jury is out whether that memo is actually authentic or not. But the other thing I wanted to point out was regarding whether Iran wants to use nuclear umbrella to advance Shiite interests. I also have doubts about that because the fact is, aside from Iran and Iraq, the rest of the Middle East is Sunni, and those Sunnis are as devout and as faithful to their religion as Iran is. And Iran and Iraq together are a small minority in the Middle East in terms of the Muslim population. What Iran wants to do, in my opinion, is to be a player, to be counted as a heavyweight in the Middle East, so that anything that is supposed to be done in the Middle East, Iran should be a partner to it. After all, Iran has a lot of influence in Iraq. Iran has a lot of influence in Afghanistan. Iran also has a lot of influence in Central Asia. And Iran wants to regain its historic importance in that region. So I believe that's what they are after, rather than trying, for example, to advance Shiite interests in that region. I mean, what can Iran do about Saudi Arabia, where about 90% of the population is Sunni, and they are not only Sunni, they are Wahhabi Sunni, who are the most devout, the most conservative branch of Islam. There is nothing that Iran can do about that.
Who are the other players in the Middle East that they want to be on par with?
Well, I mean, obviously, Israel is the most important country in that sense. Iran is another country, and Saudi Arabia, because of its oil wealth and financial resources, is another player. And Egypt is also an important player.
Turkey?
Turkey considers itself mostly as a European country, but yes, as a Muslim country that has developed its democracy, Turkey is a very important player.
I just noticed that the Turkish prime minister came out against Israel doing anything towards Iran.
It would be
met with displeasure by the Turkish authorities.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that there are some ways to untangle these knots, but before I get there, I want to mention that we can't forget when, in the aftermath of the American invasion of Iraq, when there was a lot of learning that took place all over the world. And one thing that was learned in Tehran was if you don't have nuclear weapons, that's what makes you vulnerable to a regime-changing invasion by an American government.
They looked at North Korea, they looked at Iraq, and they said, oh, look which one got overthrown.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Now, what Israel has tried to establish is that it's not that you have to actually explode a bomb. You have to be able to convince the world that you have the capacity without necessarily exploding it. and you get that kind of invincible regime protection. That was the theory. And Iran is in that sense, trying out that theory. Now, I think two ideas about untangling the knots. One of them is when you is to start to think much more about Iran in terms of domestic politics and not monolithic ideological or cultural vectors. So when Dani Aiello says Iran is out to dominate the Middle East and turn it into a Shia region, that's an example of ideological, cultural, monolithic interpretation of where an foreign policy comes from.
That's the Israeli politicians.
Well, at least Aiello's. But if you say that the opposition in Iran that we may support because it's democratizing sees in a nuclear issue a way for it to be more hawkish than Ahmadinejad and therefore object to compromises with the West, then we can understand that what comes out of Iran back and forth, its position on whether it will trade or export some kinds of enriched uranium that seem very complicated and sneaky to us, can be the result of competition between factions, and actually, as I just tried to argue, some of the factions that we might prefer, that we would prefer that they would be running Iran, might be more hawkish on this or that proposal for compromise. So that's one way for us to improve our ability to untangle the knots.
To understand the forces, the internal forces.
Yes, and to understand that what we hear out of Iran is a product of the of victories and defeats in inter-bureaucratic and inter-political games more than they are a settled, clear, a well-pursued conspiratorial process. Another point to be made is that ultimately I do think the principle of equality in international relations has got to be used and applied in order to manage the whole transition to a world, to another world where there's not just five countries that have nuclear weapons and they're all trustworthy. In order to defang that world, in order to prevent proliferation in an uncontrolled way, it's going to be necessary for all nuclear weapons capacities to be managed in all countries. So this could be an opportunity to take away this opacity, take away this yes, I have it, no, I don't opportunity by denuclearizing the Middle East as a whole, by treating the Israeli and Iranian and other and Pakistani, other Middle Eastern nuclear potentials in more or less the same way. Get inspections everywhere, get a regime everywhere, get understandings everywhere, even if that might mean Israel becoming an official part of the nuclear club. That might make things in some ways easier. What I'm suggesting at this point is simply to open up the conversation, because without opening up that conversation, it's easy for the Iranian regime to portray all efforts to manage their nuclear capacity development as a product of support for Israel.
You agree with those two points?
I think there are three points here. One is, first of all, as Professor Lustig pointed out, Iran's nuclear program is supported nationally by our groups. But at the same time, the reformists, the more democratic groups, have always wanted to reach an accommodation with the rest of the world. And that's why President Khatami, when he was president, agreed to suspend Iran's nuclear program, enrichment program, from October 2003 to August of 2005, the last day that he was in office, because they wanted to open up the nuclear program to the world, to convince the world that it is a peaceful program. The other important point is that Iran believes that there is a double standard here, as Professor Lustig also pointed out. Let me give you an example. Before the world knew anything about Natanz uranium enrichment facility, the only nuclear program that the world knew about it in Iran was the Bushehr reactor that that Russia is completing in southern Iran. And the United States and Israel at the same time always insisted that that reactor can be used to train Iranian scientists, and out of it, a nuclear weapon program can be born. So that was the main objection at that time. But now, at this time, the United States, France, and Russia have signed agreement with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Egypt, Oman, to give them the same nuclear technology that they were complaining about Iran getting it before the Natanz uranium enrichment facility came to surface. So this is sort of a double standard. At the same time, the International Atomic Energy Agency has forced Iran to do things that are beyond its legal obligation towards the safeguard agreements. For example, they want intrusive inspections, which Iran allowed them to do. But when the Iranian parliament refused to ratify the additional protocol, Iran stopped implementing it. And at the same time, Iran had pointed out that if they do it, they do it on a volunteer basis. But now they expect that to continue. So that's, again, another double standard that that Iran feels that the West is applying to it. The third issue is Iran has supported a nuclear-free Middle East. Iranian leader, at least in words, they have always supported a nuclear-free Middle East because they think that it is in their interest that Middle East be free of nuclear weapon, which of course it means that Israel should give up its nuclear
does
nuclear
that weaken weapon. Israel if there's a nuclear free Middle East?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not the person who should talk about this because I'm not an expert, but obviously Israel has the most modern army, the best air force, the best trained army. I don't believe any country in that region is in any position to hurt Israel in any way, shape or form in a very significant way.
Are the nuclear weapons destabilizing the region and not helping Israel?
It's hard to say that having a nuclear monopoly in a region doesn't make you stronger, and giving that up somehow doesn't weaken you. Of course, strong and weak, it all depends what you're measuring. To what extent can Israel do
Israel's
things?
Israel's measuring its survival, right?
Right. Well, from a survival point of view, I don't think in terms of surviving an attack, that's not the issue. The question is, if Israel's going to survive in the long run, it has to integrate, be accepted in the region. So the real question is whether a denuclearization that involves Israel joining the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty can be wedded to a comprehensive peace agreement that does integrate Israel into the region. Although the current Israeli government is not close to signing on to such a thing, other Israeli governments have been. So in general, from an historic point of view, we're not that far away. But that would be the long-term survival imperative, is to find a way to become a part of the Middle East permanently. It's not really the existence of nuclear weapons that necessarily is a threat, but the transition to a new state. And I think we can see that true if we go back to the 1967 war. A fantastic book was published in 2007 by two Israeli journalists, Ginor and Remez, published by Yale University Press, called Foxbats Over Dimona. We've always known that the Soviets were doing something Machiavellian on the Syrian front that helped precipitate the war in 1967 between Israel and the Arab world and many of the states. We didn't know what, and those archives have never been opened. But some people have been talking, and these two journalists put together a spectacular story showing that the Soviets were trying to trigger a war, having pre-positioned their most advanced weaponry, including Foxbat fighter bombers, to take out the Dimona reactor and Israel's nuclear weapons capacity. They'd been informed by an Israeli high-level spy that Israel would have, in 1965, that Israel would have the nuclear weapons very soon, within a couple years. 1967 war was, in essence, triggered by the hysterical response of others who did not want a country in the Middle East to suddenly develop nuclear weapons. That's the situation we're in now, except it's not the Soviet Union that's worried about a nascent Israeli bomb, but Israel that's worried about a nascent Iranian bomb. And now, finally, I'd just point out that actually it seems that in the months leading up to the 67 war, Israel did rapidly put together two warheads that it, and had nuclear capacities when it went into the war, but we were spared the use of those because of how quick the war was. But the entire Middle East, or the Yom Kippur War, all of these terrible things that have happened came out, it might be said, out of the hysteria having to do with the Israeli move to transform the nuclear profile of the Middle East. Now we are in an analogous situation with the Iranians. This is a very dangerous period, not because the Iranians would use the bomb, but because of the difficulty of transitioning.
And the Israelis are the ones at the center of that hysteria?
They're the ones who've been stoking it. I was at a talk by Benjamin Netanyahu several years ago, a private talk only to invited people at the University of Pennsylvania. He spent an hour glorifying his brilliance as finance minister and getting the Israeli economy under control. Then he stopped and said, I'm going to spend the next 10 minutes, and he never took questions, the last 10 minutes on the most important question facing the country and the world. And he went on a rant about the Iranian nuclear capacity. This was several years ago, which I could only think of in ancient terms as, you know, Tehran delenda est, Tehran must be destroyed. And he was essentially saying, if the United States doesn't destroy this regime with a military attack, we are going to. I've never seen a politician use such strong language. He is now, of course, prime minister of the country.
So is that hysteria or is that Machiavellian tactics to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Europe or the U.S.?
No, this is Israelis are very scared. They're very scared. Some of it is they've been trained to be scared on it, about it. Others, there's some deep psychological reasons having to do with the Holocaust, but also having to do with something that Chagai Ram, in a brilliant book on Iranophobia, an Israeli academic, has written, showing that in many respects, the Shah's Iran, in his idea of invoking and resuscitating an ancient culture and returning that ancient culture of the Persians and the Persian kings to the Middle East to make of that culture and state a great power, that this was an inspiration to Zionists and reassurance that their idea wasn't so crazy, that you could take an ancient people with an ancient connection to the land and turn it into a modern Western important military and political and economic state. And so when the Shah went down, replaced by the ultimate image of what some Israelis have called a Levantine dunghill, as Chagai Ram quotes it, this was shattering for Israel. Israel had developed very close ties with the Shah's Iran economically in terms of security services, politically and ideologically and culturally in this sense. And now what happened to Iran, in some deep way, this could happen to Israel. So there are so many psychological issues that come together for Israelis on Iran that it's quite easy to understand where this hysteria is coming from, even if it's not coming from the actual threat of the use of Iranian nuclear weapons.
I'm going to let you respond to that question of hysteria, but let me take a break first, Professor Sahimi, and then we'll do that, and then we'll take some of your calls as well. We're looking at Iran, Israel, and the nuclear impasse with Dr. Mohammad Sahimi and Dr. Ian Lustig. This is Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
Mohammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for pioneering the concept of microlending. Now he plans to help the poorest of the poor by engaging in something he calls social business. Mohammad Yunus joins us Friday night during the 9 o'clock hour. 94.9 KUOW News and Information.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. SCCA recognizes that where people are treated first for cancer often matters. SCCA's doctors treat lung, breast, and other forms of cancer, including prostate and colon. Information at seattlecca.org.
What were the top neglected news stories of 2009? You know, the important stories that didn't get enough coverage. I'm Ross Reynolds. It's the topic at noon on The Conversation. I hope you can join us.
We'd like to hear from you. Which news stories do you think didn't get enough coverage this year? Call our feedback line right now, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. 51 degrees overcast in Seattle. Today's high in the 50s, cloudy and breezy with occasional rain. Tonight's low near 43, cloudy with rain. Tomorrow's high 49, chance of rain in the morning, then rain likely in the afternoon. It's 9:40.
It's Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. We're talking about Israel, Iran, and nuclear weapons, the sanctions, the discussions, and what the psychology is in the Middle East with Dr. Ian Lustig, who's a professor at University of Pennsylvania and studies these issues, and Dr. Mohammad Sahimi, who is a professor at the University of Southern California, also looking at these issues. I want to get your thoughts on what Professor Lustig was saying about the sort of the hysteria, and also if it's real or if it matters if it's real.
Well, I have no doubt that ordinary Israeli citizens do fear the possibility of Iran having a nuclear weapon, for historical reason, for the fact that Holocaust killed 6 million Jews and many other reasons. But I think part of the hysteria is just driven by military political establishment in Israel. They want that. They want to act sort of crazy so that they would get the rest of the world to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon.
Prevent through the sanctions?
Sanctions and even possibly attack if it's necessary. They I don't think they are in a position to actually attack Iran.
But they look at Iraq and they think, oh, that worked well. Let's try that in Iran?
Precisely. And you pointed out a very important point. Iranians looked at Iraq and you look at North Korea. North Korea has 6 to 10 nuclear warheads, so leave them alone. Iraq doesn't have it, so let's attack and invade and occupy them. So Iranians learned their lesson. So what the political military establishment in Israel wants is to get the rest of the world to do this, to prevent Iran from having nuclear weapon. And by the way, I must also mention that at this point, at least, there is no evidence that Iran actually has a nuclear weapon program.
Do you think a program? So you're not convinced that they're actually pursuing a weapon?
My own opinion, and I have expressed this in many articles, is that Iran wants to put itself in a position that it can actually make nuclear weapons.
Turn the screw, like Professor.
Yes, under a national emergency, when there is a threat to national security of Iran. People call it the Japan model, because Japan has all the capability to make nuclear weapon on a short notice, but short of actually making it. Japan has uranium enrichment program, has all the know-how and technology to do it, but hasn't actually produced it. Same thing with Germany and same thing with many other European countries. So in my opinion, Iran wants to put itself in a position that it can actually do it if there is a grand threat to Iran's national security and territorial integrity. They know very well that if they actually cross the line and make nuclear weapon, then that will start a nuclear weapon race with Arab countries of the Middle East that is not in Iran's national interest. And therefore, at this point, at least, I'm not convinced that they actually want to produce it, but they want to put themselves in a position that they can do it if there is an emergency national threat to Iran's territorial integrity.
One little side note on that. Then you mentioned that the other countries in the Middle East are getting some nuclear capability through the U.S. and the EU. Does Iran support that? Does that destabilize their notions?
Iran has actually Iran has made contradictory statements. On one hand, Iran has pointed out that, oh, look, this is double standard, because we were doing the same thing in the 1990s. We were trying to complete our Bushehr reactor, and the United States and Israel objected to it because they said that, well, Iranian scientists will learn from this, and therefore a nuclear weapon program may be born out of this. But at the same time, Iran has said that we support peaceful use of nuclear technology for all countries. And in fact, Iran has said that we are even willing to export uranium enrichment technology to other countries. So Iran is speaking on both sides of his mouth at this point.
All right, I'm going to turn to the phone calls, but just, and we'll expand on this later, but do the Israelis believe that the U.S. or the EU could be somehow motivated to attack Iran?
I believe that they do think that that's possible. Until recently, there's been extreme skepticism that sanctions will work, and mostly there is still skepticism about that. That is, of course, what the Soviets had in mind. They didn't want to initiate an attack against Israel. They wanted the Egyptians and the Syrians to do it, and then they would come in under the radar and take care of Dimona.
What do you think?
What do I think?
Do you think it's a possibility that the U.S. and the EU would physically attack?
No, I don't.
Do you?
No, I don't think so.
So this just plays back into this psychology that's in the region itself, huh?
Well, we'll be talking more about this at the town hall tonight.
All right, let me go to Richard in Madrona. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Your speakers are attributing hysteria in Israel to incitement by Israel's leaders and to memories of the Holocaust in part. But I wonder, wouldn't a more direct explanation be the actual rhetoric that's emanating from Iran's leaders about destruction of the state of Israel and denial of the Holocaust, and also the fact that Iran is sponsoring Hezbollah and Hamas, two of Israeli's prime enemies on their borders who are firing rockets at them. Wouldn't those be more direct?
Isn't the evidence right in front of them? Yeah, is it what Richard says, Professor Lessig? Isn't the evidence right in front of them about Iran's intentions?
Well, the question is whether rhetoric it should be considered to be evidence of an actual threat. It is if you're psychologically set and so fearful to begin with or insecure that that kind of rhetoric is enough to trigger the demand that that threat or the theory of the threat be eliminated. And I'm arguing that in Israel, there's obviously fears for security for the reasons that you suggest. Israel has been attacked and will continue to be attacked by its neighbors, but it's also because of a deep-seated kind of trauma having to do with the Holocaust, so that it's, as in any post-traumatic stress kind of situation, there are certain things that can trigger trigger the reimagination of the event as if it's happening again or about to happen. And I think that Ahmadinejad plays that extremely cleverly, exploiting that weakness in Israel and making Israel overplay its hand and expose its own politically vulnerable nuclear posture by demanding things, the world to treat Iran in a way that it refuses to be treated.
But to both of you, first, Professor Simi, what about Hezbollah? What about Hamas and the fear that is often voiced that Iran will funnel ever more sophisticated weapons to those groups?
Well, first of all, let me explain this. There is not a monopoly of opinion in Iran regarding Israel. Ahmadinejad and hardliners have said that they prefer a one-state solution to the Middle East, a state in which Palestinians and Jewish people can live side by side. That's their official position. Reformists, on the other hand, during President Khatami's presidency, said that any solution that is acceptable to Palestinians is also acceptable to Iranian government and Iranian people. Khatami famously said that we cannot be more Palestinians than Palestinians. So there is not a monopoly of opinion about Israel in Iran. At the same time, what Ahmadinejad said about destruction of Israel was misinterpreted. What he meant was not the physical destruction of Israel, but the collapse of the Israeli political system akin to what happened to the Soviet Union. It wasn't something new. It was what Ayatollah Khomeini had said 30 years earlier, and he simply repeated it. Now, regarding Hezbollah, first of all, we have to separate, in my opinion, Hamas and Hezbollah. Hamas is a Palestinian movement that will exist with or without Iranian help. Hezbollah, on the other hand, is an ally of Iran, and Iran looks at Hezbollah as a strategic threat to its defense against Israel. That's how Iran views Hezbollah in Lebanon, not as a force that it would actually try to destroy Israel, but as a first line of defense against Israel. That's how Hezbollah is viewed in Tehran by Iranian leaders. So there is a significant difference about how one views Israel, Hezbollah from Israeli point of view, and how Hezbollah is viewed and used by Iranian leader from Tehran point of view. These are completely different. They are not the same.
Hmm. All right, Jeff's in Linwood. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have three points that I'd like to bring up, and maybe the visitors can comment. First, of course, was stated my. In making the comparison between North Korea, I wouldn't be surprised at all that Iran is moving at 100% speed. I mean, if I were the head of Iran, that's what I would be doing. When I listen to the rhetoric coming from United States and from Israel, promising, not just threatening, but promising to destroy Iran and its infrastructure, which of course means everything that supports life in Iran, I would say let's make that bomb before these guys really go bananas on us. So it is quite logical. I think we're approaching it with a hypocrisy of standards, which is causing even less trust between Iran and the West than would have been otherwise. In that we turn a blind eye to Israel and make deals with India, which exempt military development and still give them nuclear capacity. And for Iran, we're just completely bloody-minded. In the reprocessing part where we are saying that, Russia or some other country will reprocess your nuclear material for your energy and other needs, can people not understand Iran's paranoia that says, hey, what if tomorrow these countries place an embargo on us just for any reason that they like? Then Iran will be stranded with no capacity to develop its own reprocessing system. And finally, the Middle East. The Middle East is quite rightly scared of Iran because, for example, Arabia has about 15-20% Shia population that it treats worse than dogs in the desert. And they're afraid that if Iran gets influential and strong, Arabia, God forbid, may have to turn a little bit more towards democracy and give human rights, basic human rights, to their Shia population.
What do you think about? Let me get reaction there, Jeff. Especially that last notion of how this fits into that larger question of the Middle East, Professor Lustig. Is that part of the geopolitics being debated here? That there people are concerned about, the other nations are concerned about democracy erupting or the Shia rising up.
Well, I really think that the whole question of Shia versus Sunni this is not connected in any direct way to what's actually happening. This is just part of the rhetorical stew that's been bubbling around. So I don't put much into that. I think that the question of where hysteria comes from and isn't rhetoric enough to produce it. I think it's useful to remember to ask when Khrushchev said to the United States, "We will bury you." And actually, they had the ability to do it on a moment's notice. Okay, so let our listeners imagine back in the 1960s that we had a country—
where we were all under our desks.
Right. And we knew that there was an ideology over there that believed that we should be gone from the earth, that there shouldn't be any capitalist countries, and an announcement that we will bury you. And they have the capacity to do it. In a minute, in 20 minutes, they could incinerate our country. And yet we were able to maintain ourselves pretty well and eventually go on to prevail in the Cold War. So it's clearly that not just rhetoric is not enough to trigger hysteria. What you have in Israel is that a country that has an overwhelming nuclear deterrent. Iran has no nuclear weapons. So why should rhetoric trigger that kind of hysteria? The reason is deep psychological, cultural, and political conditions in Israel.
What's your reaction?
I totally agree. As I said, there is no question that ordinary Israeli citizens are deeply scared of what Iran might have. And this, of course, has historical roots that nobody can deny. So there is no question. But at the same time, as I said earlier, I also think that part of the hysteria is sort of artificial, is driven by military political establishment in Israel in order to get the rest of the world to do something about Iran's nuclear program that would benefit Israel.
When you look at untangling these knots, you both started by sort of looking at what the different nuclear umbrellas would create. And Professor Lustig, you talked about maybe the first step being to acknowledge transparency. Where do you see, Professor, where we start to take here to untangle some of these problems?
You mean regarding Iran's nuclear program?
If we accept that Iran's building a nuclear program, if we sort of take the notion that we understand their impetus for this at this point, what are the steps? What are the reasonable steps? We see what the Europeans and the U.S. are doing right now. What would be more reasonable?
The reasonable step, in my view, are that to recognize first that Iran has legitimate national security concerns. A country as large as Iran, as important as Iran, which historically has been attacked and invaded by many countries, and at the same time, despite all the rhetorics and propaganda against Iran, Iran hasn't invaded any country for the past 275 years. So the first step is to recognize that a country like Iran, which on three sides is surrounded by U.S. forces, and on its southeastern borders has a country like Pakistan, which is armed with nuclear weapon and run by some military hardliners, and a country in which radical Islamic groups are active. And on its west side, there is Israel with 400 nuclear weapons. And its north side, there is Russia with thousands of nuclear weapons. This country has legitimate national security concerns. So long as those national security concerns are not recognized and are not addressed, regardless of who is in power in Tehran, the same type of program may be pursued by a completely democratic government, a completely liberal person. Because Iran's concerns for its national security and territorial integrity are legitimate and have historical roots. So that's the first step. These concerns have to be recognized and have to be answered, addressed.
That's Professor Mohammad Sahimi, who studies and writes extensively on Iran's political development and nuclear programs. I give you about a minute to give me that same answer.
Well, I think there's one topic
same,
we haven't...
To the same question you may not give
me. There's one topic we haven't mentioned, that's proliferation. And I think that that is a real issue, that a lot of the fear having to do with the Iranian nuclear development is, will they be able to control it? Will it proliferate? Will it go to terrorists? Will it go to unstable regimes? And I think that the record of countries secretly developing these capacities is not encouraging. North Korea proliferated as was secretly developing. Pakistan proliferated as was secretly developing. Israel proliferated. And South Africa got its nuclear bomb thanks in large measure to Israel's help when it was developing its capacity. So I think we do need to attend to this issue. I think that we have to do whatever we can to make sure that the NPT that Iran is a signatory to is enforced and enforceable. And if that means treating all countries equally, then so be it.
So does that mean that we that's the, if we could make that the actual conversation, non-proliferation, we'd get to some stability in the Middle East?
The main way to disentangle these knots, in addition to understanding Iranian politics better, is to realize that we have to transition to a period, a point where the NPT is universal, it's well enforced, and in the Middle East that means tied to a comprehensive peace agreement. You can't separate the politics from the technologies of weaponry.
Brings the U.S. back into this. We had some good emails and questions about the U.S.'s own role in supplying aid to Israel and its own legality if it's supplying aid to a nuclear state. We're going to talk about these issues. Well, you are going to talk about these issues tonight at 7 p.m. Iran, Israel, U.S. resolving the nuclear impasse. That's a town hall. You can find out more information. Start at our website, KUOW.org. We have links to the event. Dr. Ian Lustig is a professor and Bess Heyman Chair in Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Mohammad Sahimi is a professor of Chemical Engineering, Materials Science, and NIAC, professor of Petroleum Engineering at the University of Southern California. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. Thank you for your phone calls and your emails. Weekday produced by Katie Sewell, Sage Van Wing, Jason Pagano answering your phone calls.
It's a minute before 10. KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, KUOW 1340 AM Tumwater, Olympia.
Support for KUOW comes from Plymouth Congregational Church, presenting music of Bach and Beethoven, Friday, December 18th at noon, featuring James Garlick, violin, and Judith Cohen, piano, in support of First Place, Educating Homeless Children. More at PlymouthSeattle.org. Support for KUOW comes from HopeLink. This year, the demand for services has surged while resources to help the most vulnerable have dwindled. Each year, HopeLink serves thousands with food, home, and help. Those who need help and those who wish to help can get information by calling 425-869-6000.
The holiday season is upon us, so what's different for you this year? Go to KUOW.org, click on the light bulb at the Public Insight Network, and tell us about your holiday plans.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Medical Centers, with 8 neighborhood primary and specialty care partners serving the Puget Sound region. Same-day scheduling and all major insurance accepted to fit individual and family needs. Appointments at pacmed.org or 1-888-4-PACMED.
NPR News headlines.